Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, we run the rule over 2023. Was it a good or bad one for investors? And we take a look at what 2024 has in store. Will we see recession or recovery? What impact will elections have on both sides of the pond? What next for bonds? For gold? Can the UK stock market be the surprise performer? And what are the other key themes you need to look out for next year? Also today, Boots Pension, has my early retirement been robbed? And daughters swapping homes, do they face a future tax sting? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, the UK is at risk of recession after revised figures show that the economy shrank between July and September. Coupled with waning inflation, the Bank of England is, despite protestations, being tipped by markets to cut interest rates multiple times in 2024, some suggestions as early as February even. But what will it all mean for investors? Before we dive into the new year, we'll take stock of 2023. Not over yet, but almost. So was it a good or a bad year? Welcome to you both, Simon. 2023 for investors. Obviously, we'll be digging into all these themes in a lot more detail, but briefly, A, B minus, D, fail.
Well, it's an interesting one because it very, very much depends what you were invested in. It was a good year for passive investors, true passive investors who decided to track the global stock market. And by doing that, will have been massively exposed to the US stock market, which meant that they also benefited from the rise of the so-called Magnificent Seven. And these are the seven big tech firms that have hugely powered investor returns this year. And if you remove them from the S&P 500, from the S&P 500, if you detach them from that, investment returns look very different. If you then do that again and remove that from the global index, investment returns look very different. If you've been a very targeted investor, you could have done very well. So, for example, we have got some stocks that have done spectacularly well this year, and then we've got some that have gone relatively nowhere. So I'll just do a little scorecard running through the major indices before we get into a bit more detail. But, yeah. For example, the S&P 500, that is the, I would argue, the leading US index and the one to be invested in rather than the Dow Jones, which is a bit of a quirky one. The S&P 500 is up 24% year to date. That's pretty good. The FTSE 100, on the other hand, is up 2.1% year to date. And actually, if you look at the chart for the year, it's just a succession of like up, down, up, down, up, down. The German DAX index is up 18.4% year to date, and the French CAC 40 index is up 15%. The other one I'm going to look at as well is something that I wouldn't recommend investing all of your money into and just track, because it is hugely volatile, and that is the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ, which is the US's really kind of tech heavy and influenced index, that is up a stonking great 44% year to date. So the answer to did you do well has largely been, were you exposed to the main US stock market and the tech heavy elements of it? And if you were, you probably did very well. If you looked at the FTSE and went, you know what, it was the best performing global index last year, it's full of undervalued companies, there's going to be a catalyst for their share prices to move up, and things are only going to get better because, you know, don't buy expensive stuff, buy cheap stuff, which, you know, is the principle behind value investing, then you would have seen much lower returns.
Tanya, before we dig into the key themes to look out for next year, what were the things that stood out for you? Some will be more obvious than others, but perhaps some of the more niche ones from the last year of investing.
Well, I think the biggest thing has been AI, because it has driven the big rise in the US stock market, which has, if you're a global investor, has also turbocharged your returns this year. And there's a big question as to whether that has gone too far and whether it's now in a bubble territory and it's massively overvalued. Will it actually bring what people hope it will bring? But the thing about it is that it really might. And we could be sitting here next year with these companies really having taken off yet again, because we don't know. A lot of the commentary I've been getting about next year is they've been pointing out, you know, whole new products are being created on the back of AI. There's so many efficiencies that it could bring to companies. We actually don't really know the extent of it. And ordinary companies that have got nothing to do with technology could end up being absolutely transformed or potentially wiped out as well. So we're entering a period of, well, a great uncertainty, but real excitement as well. I actually think that's been the biggest deal for investors this year. It's not a niche one, but bonds has also been a very interesting year for bonds. I think we're going to get onto that later, but those are the two standouts for me.
Interesting that you've both mentioned there big tech, AI. I have to say, personally, reporting on this and podcasting and all sorts of things that I've been doing over the last 12 months have been massively influenced by particularly Gen AI. Simon, Tanya said, us sitting here next year, will we still be talking about it? What else will we be talking about this time next year?
This time next year, what are we going to be talking about? I think what's going to come back into play is this question of recovery or recession. So we are looking at a position where everybody has decided interest rates have peaked, and the markets have decided they're going to be cut quite aggressively next year. Is that going to happen? We talked about this last week on the podcast, you know, but the investment thing here is that investors are almost banking on this in some places. You have seen a really strong rally in the stock market since October the 27th. It hit its kind of recent low on October the 27th. In the US and in the UK, and the market has rallied hard since then. And you've seen a strong rally for risk on stuff, things that are seen as more, you know, risky, jam tomorrow, the tech stocks, all that kind of stuff. There's been a hard rally for some of that stuff, things that were a bit unloved. I mean, so for example, Scottish Mortgage, very, very popular UK investment trust, invests in businesses that it thinks are going to, you know, disrupt the world over the next 5 to 10 years, holds them for the long term, has been hit very, very hard after doing very, very well, was hit very, very hard by the tech crash, the rise in interest rates, you know, all that kind of stuff. Now, it's nowhere near back to where it was, but its share price has risen substantially in that rally that we've seen. The question is, are investors getting ahead of themselves? And what's going to happen when interest rates are not cut as aggressively as they think they're going to be? I mean, maybe they are going to be cut as aggressively as they think they're going to be. But to be honest, you know, some of these interest rate expectations are looking at either inflation continuing to plummet and going straight through 2% target rates, and central banks suddenly running behind trying to get inflation back up. Are they really going to do that? Or basically, we're going to see a fairly hefty recession, which is going to trigger these rate cuts. But the fairly hefty recession is not going to be great for the economies that are, you know, still struggling. And, you know, the greatest risk to investors is that the US actually manages to pull off the soft landing that everyone was questioning whether it could do. Then everybody decided that maybe it was pulling off the soft landing. But the expectation for rate cuts at the moment that's been fueling all of this investor hope over the last couple of months has now gone past it to back to almost like hard landing territory. Because if the US does pull off the soft landing, are they really going to cut rates by a whole percentage point next year or even more, as some analysts are suggesting? Yeah. Same thing with the Bank of England. Markets are pricing in a 50% chance of the base rate being cut in March, thanks to the inflation fall this week. The Bank of England is adamant that it is not cutting interest rates anytime soon. But there were three people voted for a rise last time round. Nobody voted for a cut. Now, things could dramatically change around between now and March, or you might find that the market's got a bit overexcited and is running ahead of itself.
Just briefly there, Simon, what would it take, do you think, for that to happen, for the Bank of England to cut? Because bear in mind, we have rises to the national minimum wage coming in. There's a lot of businesses that are pricing that already. That could feed inflation. So what would it take for the Bank of England to perform quite a significant, what would seem a U-turn, when you said three of them voted for a 25 basis point rise last time?
And that vote is looking behind the curve, out of touch, whatever you want to call it. We had figures out, we were recording this on Friday, we had figures out this morning showing GDP fell, you know, 0.1% in the previous quarter, okay? So things are not looking so good, economically speaking. But, you know, you're much more likely, as we were talking about last week, to end up in a situation where we tread water on interest rates than we suddenly start cutting them. So I think things would have to go south very quickly over the next couple of months. You'd need to have some really quite poor Christmas sales figures coming in. You'd need to have more stress showing in the housing market and in the mortgage market, business investment falling, a number of other things, the kind of stuff that points towards recession and towards a recession that isn't just a mild recession that we've already caused and we can't do anything about, but a sort of harder recession that we need to do something about, because otherwise the recession is going to, you know, start to snowball itself and make things worse. So I don't think we want to see the scenario that would mean rates would be cut, because it wouldn't be a great scenario. And I don't know whether, you know, that's something that's being taken into account with the recent market moves that we've seen. The one thing I would say is we're going into another year where the FTSE, you know, the FTSE All Share, you know, UK large caps, but also mainly UK mid caps and smaller companies look cheap. It is one of the best value stock markets in the world. And we are seeing overseas companies, private equity, come in and repeatedly, you know, buy those companies. And there's this line of like, if you don't buy them, they will. And that's what's happening here. And at some point, but this argument's been going on for years, at some point there will be that catalyst that suddenly lights the touch paper underneath the UK market. And last year, the UK market was one of the best performing markets, but ironically, and in the most FTSE way possible, it was one of the best performing markets only because all the others did so badly. What we're waiting for is the year where it's one of the best performing markets because it did really well. And I guess, you know, the thing you've got to be concerned about is just presuming that the thing that happened this year is going to happen next year. And investors got caught out last year on that when we had the tech crash after a year in which they'd all gone up. Collectively, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, and Tesla have not only outshone the wider tech industry this year, but they've also driven a substantial bulk of global equity gains. As I said, since January, those M7 stocks have achieved a cumulative return of 109%. You know, whereas, as I said, the S&P is up 24%. So, you know, can they continue to outperform to that level? I'm not so sure.
Dania, can the UK stock market be the surprise performer? Will we have a recovery rather than a recession?
Well, every year when I compile the investment outlook, I look at everything that comes in, all the investing experts send something in, and they're always saying exactly what Simon has said. This is the year for the UK. It's so undervalued. This is a great opportunity. And they also, at the same time, offer words of caution about the US. They say the US is expensive. Obviously, you need exposure. But, you know, don't go overboard. Just have a good allocation to it. But, you know, don't be overweight in an expensive market. This year, I'm getting the same on the US as ever, despite the great year it's had. But I'm sensing disillusionment from on the UK stock market. I think they've given up saying year after year, oh my God, this is the year, it's so cheap. They're still saying that, but some of the people who usually say that have not said anything. And the people who have said it are saying it in quite dispirited terms, like they're losing hope. Obviously, if you're going to be a contrarian, this could be the year. They've actually, you know, given up on it. So maybe maybe it will happen. In terms of the recession and what might happen with interest rates, well, whether there'll be a recession, I think that actually the Bank of England gets a lot of stick, and it certainly did, including on this podcast, for waiting quite a long time before it started hiking rates. But we have been kept out of recession this year. It has bumped along, the economy not going anywhere, but at least we haven't seen anything disastrous, and employment has continued to be high. When there is a recession, one of the worst, most heartbreaking things is where, you know, company after company gets rid of loads and loads of people, and thank goodness we haven't seen that. The central bankers, both in the UK and the US, have struck me as a bit grumpy about this rate cutting hysteria that Simon's been describing. I think that they're going to want to really make sure they put the squeeze on inflation before they start doing anything, absent, obviously, shocks, a sudden, you know, dramatic fall into recession, because the worst thing that could possibly happen now is they could maybe get away with a month, maybe two, of inflation starting to go up again. But if all this sort of, you know, hard work they've put into getting inflation down went into reverse, people would be very, 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 very upset about it. So I think they're going to stick to their guns for quite a long time, probably holding for quite a long time until they're really, really sure. That does mean, you know, that puts us at greater risk of recession. But it's always a tightrope for them, because the decisions they make now don't feed through for, you know, another 18 months, maybe. They're in an incredibly difficult position. And I often try and decipher what they're saying going by I know it sounds really stupid, but the tone of voice and this slightly irked tone that you're getting is telling me, no, they're really not going to think about rate cuts for as long as possible until they're really, really sure about inflation.
Simon, regular listeners to the show will know we say a lot. This is not a political podcast. However, politics feeds into money decisions, absolutely. And we do have a fairly significant political event likely to take place on both sides of the pond. I'm talking about elections here. What impact will they have?
Yes, elections. That is the other thing that is going to come into play next year, quite substantially. And it's going to come into play increasingly as the year continues on. It might not feel like it, but we've been in a period of relative political stability, I guess, where we haven't had any elections for a few years. And in fact, even in the UK, we've actually managed to have the same prime minister for over a year now, which is quite astonishing, really. But the US election is obviously the one to watch. Donald Trump is polling very, very highly amongst the Republican candidates. We could be presented with the delights of another Trump versus Biden competition.
Is that the best offer?
I don't know whether that's the best that could be that may not be the best that could be offered to us, but it might be what we get. You might have to we're not going to get to choose, but no. they might be choosing off the same menu again as last time. So you know, who knows what's going to happen? And if it does come to that, who know, you know, then there's the whole, is he even going to be allowed to run, you know, the stuff that's gone on in Colorado this week. That stuff's going to snowball. He's going to make central bankers look positively cheerful when he starts getting grumpy about stuff like that. And then, the ructions that were caused at the last election when the vote came in were really quite substantial for, you know, the world's still leading democratic country. So, you know, God knows what's going to happen there. But it is going to sort of potentially start upsetting the investor apple cart a bit. And I guess the big question as well for investors there is, what are the economic impacts of this? Now, the US economy has been doing really quite well, fueled by Joe Biden's environmental subsidy green, it's not called the Green Deal, but it's, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act, it's actually officially called. That stuff, you know, this boosting the American renewable and green and everything like that industry. There's a lot of money pushing into that. Would Donald Trump continue it? Would he just tear it up? Would he stop all that money rushing in? Would he come up with some other ideas? Would it make any difference? Would it be just like you're just going to get the same thing? The same with the UK. I mean, there was a very clear economic choice the last time that we had a general election between the Boris Johnson camp and the Jeremy Corbyn camp. Is there going to be really that much difference this time round? I mean, how much of a Rizla paper can you fit between the Tories' economic policy and Labour's current economic policy? Or will there start to be concerns that actually, whilst it doesn't look like you can fit a Rizla between the two of them, actually a Labour government would be dramatically different? I don't know. But, you know, all of these things are going to start coming into play, and then you've got elections in lots of other places as well. And Tanya knows an awful lot more about the elections and politics angle of this kind of stuff than I do.
Well, Tanya, Simon's teed you up. What impact will it have?
Well, as far as the US election goes, I think that's going to be the most consequential. Obviously, we're going to be very obsessed with our own, and India is also having an important election. But with the Indian election and also our one, I think most people feel that we have got a good idea of what the outcome is going to be, whereas the American one is not only the most important, but it's the most uncertain. I'm really sorry to say this, but I think that Americans are in a constitutional crisis already because of what Simon said about whether they're even going to let Trump run. That's a big crisis right there. But we're in a situation where we've got two major wars going on, and Trump has got a very different stance on them, particularly the Ukraine war, than the Democrats and Joe Biden. And as far as markets go, it could be that Trump winning and giving up on Ukraine and the ramifications of that for Russia and its ambition, shall we say, no more than that, in Europe, would be so massive. We've already seen what happened with energy prices at the beginning of the Ukraine war. Unfortunately, geopolitics, it's not just elections, it's geopolitics, it could have an extraordinary impact on markets, investors, our everyday bills. All that being said, last time Trump was elected, markets did fine. In fact, they did well. Everyone was expecting tax cuts, so in expectation of that, investments did rather well. I think the Trump that might win this time is different from the Trump that won last time. He's much more focused on retribution and also much more determined to make really big changes in the US. And I don't think we've fully comprehended yet what big changes there could be to a democracy like America's. Like Simon says, you know, the biggest democracy in the world. He's talking about making all sorts of changes to the rule of law. And our biggest ally, not being a democracy anymore, would be absolutely seismic for the rest of us.
Goodness me. All right then, Tanya, you also mentioned bonds. Meant to be a safe place, safe bit of people's portfolio, bit all over the show this year. What next?
Well, there's been a rally in the bond market, actually, in the last few weeks after a massive sell-off and a big shock that's affected a lot of people, especially people coming up to retirement who had a lot of investments in bonds, and it's been quite serious for them. But I think it comes back to interest rates. We'll circle back round to interest rates. People are expecting cuts now, so the market is stabilising. I think the consensus really is that bonds are a good buy if you're a new buyer at the moment. Because the yield is currently elevated, you're going to get more income. But if it goes the other way, if you're a new buyer now, you'll be sitting on a capital gain. So that's the win. That's the win-win that the investing experts are saying to people who are considering getting into bonds, adding to them in their portfolio. It's been a really volatile time for bonds in the last over a year now, but the direction of interest rates is a thing to watch there.
Simon, Tanya spoke about talking to experts. You actually have an article with Laith Khalaf, Head of Investment Analysis at AJ Bell, about his thoughts for 2024. You also have a poll on this article which says, what will you put money into in 2024? Cash, savings, gilts, equities, gold, or crypto? I've not clicked on it, so I don't know what your readers say. Simon, put me out of my misery. Where will your readers be putting their money in 2024? And what did Laith have to say?
What do you think is going to be the first equities and second answer?
Oh, cash? Equities. Gone. Cash. Equities
you're just,
cash.
You're just listing them all now, Georgie. You're basically
Gilt.
Hedging your bets.
Gold. Crypto. I think crypto will be last.
Okay, right. I'll give you the rundown. Yeah. Cash savings, 44%.
All right, yeah.
Equities, aka the stock market, 34%.
Right.
Gold.
Oh, I was right. I got the top two.
Gold, 10%.
Gilts
crypto, 8%.
Ooh.
Gilts, 4%.
Ooh.
Now, gilts is interesting because bonds are meant to be the safe part of your portfolio. As Tanya pointed out, it's been a roller coaster year for the bond market and the safe part of your portfolio. The idea is that if you put your money into investment grade government bonds, governments that aren't going to go bust and are always going to give you your money back, that's the safe bit. And they act as a bit of a kind of barbell thing. So when the stock market does really, really well, gilts don't, you know, gilts for us. Luckily, we have UK government bonds denominated in our own currency, which is the ideal scenario, a government that's always going to pay its debts because it can just print money to keep paying them and so on. The money might not be worth as much as you thought. We hoped it was going to be, but it's highly unlikely we're going to default. So, you know, gilts and treasury bonds are the ones you want to go for. German bunds as well, very, very popular. So the safe part of your portfolio, and the idea is stock market does really well. It doesn't do very well. But when the stock market does badly, when things are bad, gilts do very well. The safe part of your portfolio has been on quite a roller coaster ride this year, astonishingly ending up exactly back where it was 12 months ago. The UK 10-year gilt currently yields 3.5%, and 12 months ago it yielded 3.6%. So pretty much exactly back where you were, but it has spiked all the way up to almost 5% at one point. And it's been, you know, it's been a line that doesn't look exactly like the stock market because it's not as volatile, but it has been quite volatile. And the problem is that for investors who hold gilts, if you just buy a gilt and then you hold it till maturity, you know exactly what return you are going to get and you're going to get your money back at the end of it. Most people do not buy gilts directly and do that. They buy into a bond fund. And what happens when bond yields go up and down is that the price goes up and down as well. So when yields are falling, the price goes up. And when the yield goes up, the price goes down. So the value of what you're holding falls. So if you're holding a bond fund, you might find that the value of the money you've got in there has either gone up or gone down really quite substantially over the course of the last year. And we actually even had a little mini banking crisis earlier this year over in the US when a couple of banks effectively went bust owing to this happening with US treasuries and the fact that the US bonds that they were holding as the safe parts of the capital they're required to hold actually turned out to be not so safe at all. Irony being that if they just sat on their hands for long enough, the whole thing would have blown over because the prices have gone back to where they were. But what's also been going on with gilts, and is something that Laith mentions in his article, is there was this little trick that's been going on amongst those with deep, deep pockets, largely, who have been buying short-dated gilts and for the yield to maturity. And the way this works is older gilts will have been issued with really quite rubbish interest rates on them, or coupons, as they're known. So you might find that knocking around the place, there's some stuff from some years back that only pays, you know, 1%, 1.5%, right? Why would you buy that? Well, quite right. Nobody wants to buy that. Not when they can get a brand new one that's going to pay them 4% earlier this year. So the price of those short-dated gilts has fallen to the point where you could pick them up for, say, 90p in the pound. If you buy one of those that matures, say, for example, at the end of January next year, and you're only going to hold it for a couple of months, and you can pick it up for 90p in the pound, you know that in January, you're going to get a whole pound back for your 90p. So you don't really care about the fact that you are only going to get a pitiful rate of interest until then. It's all about, you know, the money that you're going to get back at the end and the yield to maturity. And some of those yields to maturity, once you factor in the fact that this is extremely tax friendly, doing this compares very, very favorably to the best savings accounts out there, which are also a guaranteed return. And in fact, for higher rate taxpayers, or particularly additional rate taxpayers, there's been a lot of 45p taxpayers doing this, means that they smash it. And so there's been this little mini cottage industry of people buying up short dated gilts. I mean, I think that's going to have been a kind of a bit of a flash in the pan kind of thing. And I think, you know, we're already probably starting to see that fizzle out. I think what maybe central bankers many investors will be hoping for is a much calmer bond market next year. I think what bond traders will be hoping for is more of the same. And if you want to know about bond trading, read some of Michael Lewis's early books.
Very good. Simon, also though, here, the other bottom ones, gold and crypto.
Yeah, gold been on a tear this year, hitting a new record high at one point. Crypto, though, smashing gold out of the water completely, with its volatile nature, seeing Bitcoin rise 150% year to date. It is still at 34,366 Great British pounds, considerably below the peak that was seen of just shy of 50,000 British pounds for one Bitcoin. But obviously, Bitcoin is usually done in US dollars. And at the moment, Bitcoin is trading at 43,768, whereas the peak for Bitcoin was, I'm just looking this up now as I'm talking, so about 65,000. So it's still substantially below that, but 150% return is massive. But Bitcoin is the kind of thing that can move very, very quickly. So be careful. If you are going to buy Bitcoin, only make it a very small amount of your portfolio and understand what even holding a very small amount of your portfolio that could suddenly, in a matter of weeks, drop 50% can do to the overall value of your portfolio, and that you are effectively speculating on something, and whether you can call it investing is a matter of much debate.
Well, I was going to end this particular section, Tanya, with some of your final top tips from both of you for 2024 for investors. So that's one from Simon, a couple from you, maybe.
My tips are going to be back to basics on budgeting. Obviously, savings rates have been much better this year. They might come off a bit now. I do think, though, once you've got your emergency fund sorted out, your 3 to 6 months of salary, you definitely should look at investing. And my tip, being the pensions person, is actually really seriously consider not investing in an investment ISA, but doing the cheap and easy thing of topping up your pension. You're still investing. You're probably going to be investing really cheaply because your pension scheme will be able to negotiate much lower fees than you will. You get the tax relief on top of that. Basically, for people who think, okay, I should be starting to invest now, topping up the pension is the first and easiest way to go, rather than starting thinking about opening an investment account. You can do that too, or you can do that later, but that's my budgeting tip.
Top tips from you, Simon.
What people want to hear is people telling them where to invest, right? That's always what they want. What's going to do really well? Okay, I have literally no idea, right, what's going to do really well. The only thing you can do is you can keep an eye on the sensible stuff, like keeping your charges down and things like that. You know, if you want to look at stuff that, you know, has the potential to do better, then I still think looking at stuff that looks cheap is a good move. And if you want to do that, then it's worth looking at investment trusts, because there are still many investment trusts that invest in, you know, really good stuff that is cheap, but then are also cheap themselves because they are trading at a discount anyway. So you're picking them up for less than the sum of their parts. Don't just buy because stuff's on a discount. It might be on a discount for a reason. Some stuff just perennially trades at a discount. You need to understand these things properly and look at them properly. But, you know, that is an opportunity that is potentially there. But then I would say, on the flip side, I have an investment portfolio. I have an investment ISA that would be much, much larger if I had not tried to be clever over the years and tried to pick winners. If I had simply put all of the money that I've got invested into a global tracker fund my investment portfolio would be considerably larger than it has been by trying to go, oh, well, I think Japan looks cheap. Oh, well, I think the UK looks cheap. And I'm going to back those because I think the US looks expensive. The US has looked expensive for years. And then there's the, you know, is it expensive for a reason? Yeah, but how can it stay that expensive for so long? And as I said, I'd have a lot more money if I'd just stuck it into a really simple global tracker fund. And that's why I think there's a really strong argument for making those the core of your portfolio and then having some smaller stuff around the side. And to go back to what Tanya said, actually, like, just looking at some of the elements where you're taking advantage of the tax breaks on offer to you, but the really simple ones, you know, if you put money into your pension, you will get an instant 25% uplift on the money that you put in there because you get basic rate tax relief. There are not many investments out there that give you an instant 25% uplift. In fact, if anybody ever tells you about one and it isn't paying money into your pension, run a mile, okay? Because they're probably trying to scam you. But a pension genuinely does that. So that's a pretty good way to invest. The problem is you cannot get that money until you are 55 at the moment, and that's going to be 57 pretty soon, and then that's going to keep going up. So my problem is I'm 45, right? I don't shovel loads of money into my pension because I've already got money going into my pension that I invest regularly every month. And I'm looking at that and going, well, I might want some of that money before then, you know, the extra investing that I'm doing. So mine goes into my ISA, but do put it into your ISA, because if you don't put it into your ISA, you have got capital gains tax to deal with and dividend tax to deal with. And unfortunately, we have a government that has no respect for small investors and has hit them repeatedly with a massive tax hammer in order to catch out other people doing other things. So dividend tax, for example, is way more of a burden than it once was because they've been trying to catch out people, small businesses working as limited companies and paying themselves through dividends. So we've had the dividend allowance cut substantially, and it's going to get cut all the way down to £500 next year at the same time as the rates of tax have gone up in order to try to catch people out. We've also got Jeremy Hunt, who in his wisdom decided to cut the capital gains tax allowance. That was halved last April to £6,000, and then it's going to get halved again to £3,000. And if you've got a decent stack of investments, then it was highly unlikely in the past that you were probably going to hit the, you know, roughly 12 grand capital gains tax allowance each year, right? But it's a hell of a lot easier to hit that now if you've got a reasonable amount of investments outside of an ISA. So get those investments into an ISA and potentially think about, you've missed the boat obviously for selling some last year and getting some in there, but maybe you need to sell some this year and get some in there. Get your cash savings into an ISA, because also the savings allowance, you know, £1,000, but not if you're a higher rate taxpayer. It's less then. And there's a lot more higher rate taxpayers than they were, because in their wisdom, they've frozen income tax thresholds as well. And if you're a 45p taxpayer, which you're earning a lot of money, you're on more than 125 grand. There's not that many of those, but I bet there's quite a few of them who are listening to this podcast. You don't get any personal savings allowance at all. And that personal savings allowance has not moved at all since it was brought in, despite the fact that interest rates have gone up and so on. So get your cash savings into an ISA as well. And if you look at those things, the things like putting your money into a pension, putting your money into an ISA, keeping your savings interest free of tax, you will often find that making those changes makes more of a difference to your overall wealth over the long term than worrying about which particular investment looks, you know, like it's going to do really well this year and then getting caught out because it actually does really badly.
That's it for part one.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
Welcome back. Reader question time for your pensions agony uncle, Sir Steve Webb. One for the members of Boots Defined Benefit Pension Scheme after the recent announcement it had been bought out by Legal & General. It was followed up with standard letters to all members outlining the buyout, states your reader. Also in the letter was a change to the early retirement rules. Previously, there was no penalty for taking your pension from 60 to 65 and a 4% reduction for each year taken before the age of 60 down to 55. I, says your reader, like many others, I'm in my 50s, was actively planning to take my pension early and have made financial arrangements based on figures provided by the scheme. This has now changed, Tanya, with no notice and, as far as I'm aware, no grace period. I've tried contacting the pension department by email and I'm currently waiting for a response. Can you give me any advice that may be useful to myself and other members? Tanya, before we dig into the advice, just explain to us, what does it mean for a scheme to be bought out in this sort of manner? What's the case for Boots?
Well, final salary pension schemes are the most generous and safest schemes around, but they're mostly closed to new members in the private sector. But they still exist. They're still very, very big, and they have to pay people's pensions. They have to pay a guaranteed pension until you die, which is a big burden for them because, unlike with the modern pensions that people are putting now, the employer's scheme bears all the investment risk. So what they do, if they're rich enough, if they're enough in surplus, they can basically pay an insurer to take this pension scheme off their hands. And the insurer is basically taking over the obligation to pay everybody's pension that's still in the scheme until they die. And you can understand why schemes want to do it. Schemes are attached to all sorts of big employers who have got, frankly, other things to do with their time and money than run pension schemes. I think the Boots owner is an American company. They're probably boggling at the way that we used to run pension schemes. And they understandably want shot of it. They want to sell Boots by the look of it. So they have done a deal with Legal and General, the kind of deal that final salary pension schemes do all the time. If they can afford it, that's very, very crucial. It's only the successful ones that are in surplus who can really afford to do this. And when they do the deal with the insurer, they basically go through it almost line by line about what they give their members and what they're prepared to give the members in future. There's lots of discretionary items in there, usually, which schemes might be prepared to do, such as an early retirement scheme on generous terms of the kind that Boots was obviously running. Another big one is that schemes are sometimes prepared in times of high inflation to give people a bit more, not just give the standard amount that they have to give, but be a bit more generous than that. But when the insurer takes it over, unless the scheme is willing to buy all that, to actually hand over money to retain these nice special features, then they disappear. It looks like the Boots scheme, the special discretionary stuff for dependents, which have been retained. So they've not ripped it all away. But Steve did go to Boots for an answer. And I think that they were quite straightforward about it. They couldn't afford to pay all the extra to Legal and General that would have entailed to allow people to keep on getting this very generous early retirement offer. So that's what lies behind this question. But this reader wasn't the only one who contacted Steve about this last week. And you can completely see why someone coming up to retirement who has been banking on this, and when you think as well, Boots employers are not all shop workers, but a lot of them will be shop workers who spend a lot of time on their feet. They may be looking very much forward to stopping at 60 with no cut to their pension as a result. So it's a really upsetting discovery that could upend all your plans for retirement. And that's the situation that this reader found themselves in.
There's nothing you can do? I mean, people could just willy-nilly change your... That seems quite a scary thought, doesn't it?
Well, it is definitely a shock for these people, but I think that, yes, they can do it. It's a contractual matter. They have done a deal with Legal and General. I think it is worth saying that actually passing your pension scheme over to insurer is not a really terrible thing to do. Obviously, it's had difficult consequences for people in this scheme. But you are generally thought to be a lot safer with an insurer. final salary schemes, when the employer goes bust, you know, you end up in the pension protection fund. If you're still working, you get 90% of the pension you were expecting, which is a much worse scenario. I mean, obviously, the big insurers are not infallible, but it's much more unlikely that they'll go bust than even a large successful retailer like Boots. So in terms of what Steve said, I mean, he's explained the situation and laid out all the details. But in terms of what you can do, I mean, I think you're going to have to redo your sums, potentially delay your retirement, or work out if you can still retire early, but on less than you thought you were getting. I guess you'd want to look at all your other assets and have a big think about what you can afford and whether it's worth hanging on a bit longer at work.
Yeah, won't be ideal for some. But anyway, we've got another reader question before I let you go about swapping houses. Interesting. My daughters, says your reader, each own a house, outright, no mortgage. One in Oxford, one in Cambridge. Due to changing work locations, they now wish to swap ownership of their houses. Our solicitor has advised that this can easily be done through a deed of gift, but has declined to advise on the implications for capital gains tax when either property is sold. Now, it's highly likely the Cambridge house, which has been my eldest daughter's main home from purchase in 2020, will be sold next year after she transfers ownership to her sister. As the house has increased in value since the purchase, we'd like to understand any potential liability for capital gains tax when it's sold. Simon, the answer is...
Okay, so I'm going to go through Heather Rogers' answer here, because obviously I'm not a tax expert, Heather is. So Heather makes the point that the tax implications of gifting property to family members is a common inheritance tax one, but she's not had one about house swaps before. Although these are not as rare as you might think, but there are three taxes you need to be thinking about if you're going to get involved in something like this. So one, capital gains tax; two, inheritance tax; and three, everyone's favourite tax, apart from inheritance tax, stamp duty. Hooray! The one where you pay the government for the privilege of you moving house based on how much the previous owner has made on it. We got to love that tax, haven't we? Tens of thousands of pounds because somebody who owned your house before made hundreds of grand on it. You haven't made anything. You've got to borrow tons of money just to buy a home because we've totally failed to keep house price inflation under control. But guess what? You get a massive tax bill because it's a massive benefit for you buying an expensive home. Anyway, shall I move back on to the taxes? Yeah, right. Capital gains tax. Even though this transaction is a swap rather than two independent sales, doesn't change the way the transaction is treated for capital gains tax. On any transfer of property between connected parties, the market value of that property must be taken into account rather than the amount of money actually being paid. Why is this? It's to stop people like going, I'm going to sell you my house for £2 and we'll be basing everything on that. And it's like, well, why would you sell your house for £2? It's like, because you're connected parties, your family members, you come up with a nice little deal. Will your daughters have to pay CGT? If each property being swapped was the main or only residence of its owner prior to the swap, then private residence relief should be available in the same way that it's available when you sell your home and move to another, and no capital gains tax will be due. Similarly, after the swap, providing the new home remains the main residence of its new owner, then private residence relief should also be available should the new home be sold again, in the same way that if you sold your home, moved to a new one, and then sold the new one to move again. So in this scenario, the sisters swap houses. One sister lives there for 6 months and goes, do you know what? Actually, I'm going to move. She doesn't have to pay any capital gains tax on the basis of the 6 months she lived there because it's her own home and it's her only home. And she hasn't had to pay any capital gains tax before because the house that she swapped was her own home. But there are some exceptions, particularly if one of the properties being swapped was a second home or was rented out at any time, capital gains tax would be payable and the amount due would depend on the profit made. Inheritance tax. If no money is being paid, in theory, both houses in this case are gifts. However, because for gifting one house, the gifting party is receiving another house, then the actual gift is the difference between the value of the two properties. So if person A gives person B a house worth £300,000, but only receives from person B a house worth £280,000, then A has gifted £20,000. This becomes a partially exempt transfer. If that person survives 7 years, the person who made the gift, then no inheritance tax would be due on it. And if they did die in that period, there would be a, it would go down on a sort of declining scale, how much of it was, you know, for tax purposes. Importantly, once the swap has taken place, there should be no further benefit received by the owner of the gifted property, or it would be classified as a gift with a reservation of benefit. This will change the inheritance tax position. So clearly, if the two houses are worth roughly a similar amount, not a problem. If one house is worth £1 million and one house is worth £250,000, is a problem. Stamp duty. Normally, there is no stamp duty payable on a gift, but there may be liability if the properties are not equal in value, or if there is a mortgage on one or both of the properties which are being transferred. There may be higher rates of stamp duty to pay if one party already owns another property. That is a question that your solicitor should review. So potentially, we have found a scenario where somebody may not have to pay stamp duty.
Hooray!
Hooray! Because they're just swapping two properties of a similar value. But if they're not, then, you know, they don't need to. And then, obviously, what needs to be thought about here is, are these two properties of substantially different value? Is that going to cause you a headache? And do you need to go speak to a tax expert yourself? And that's probably really quite advisable in a situation like this, if there is in any way any complications or a substantial gap in the value.
I bet when they came up with this idea, they thought, God, genius. This will be, you know, straightforward swaps. Our house, we own it. No problems.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that you think, oh, well, we could just swap.
Right.
Yeah. Why wouldn't we? If you do get a house in your stocking this year,
here's what
consider
to think
the tax
about.
Implications.
Right, we do love reader listener questions. Simon, listener corner time now. Those are reader questions. Now it's listener corner time, where we put you on a pedestal when you write to us with your, I don't know, whatever you want to write to us about. We welcome it. Simon?
Yes. This is the bit for the hardcore, right? The people who listen all the way to the end, okay? this is the bit, right? If you managed to make it through last week, you'll have listened to us boiling kettles.
Yeah, that's very
And funny. If you listen to us boiling kettles, you will have
My kettle was the fastest, by the way, out of everybody.
Your kettle wasn't the fastest.
It was!
Your kettle was the fastest out of mine, yours, and Lee's.
Oh, yeah, the one that worked
was
the better.
Not faster than the office kettle.
There we
which
go.
Is what blew Mr. Boyce completely out of the water when he maintained that his kettle only took 2 minutes to boil, and the office kettle was really slow because it gets used about 50 times a day. My argument was that it was more like a peak athlete that was totally limbered up.
Anyway, Simon, people have got this far. Let's not lose them yet.
Turned out the office kettle took 3.5 minutes. Georgie's kettle took nearly 4 minutes.
3 minutes 40. No, I wrote it down.
She's written it down on a piece of paper while she spends the next 2 weeks finding that. Mine at home took 3 minutes.
3 minutes 43. I've got the piece of paper still by my desk.
Georgie's was second. We got an email to both of us at 12:01 p.m. last Friday, just after we'd finished recording, from a certain Mr. Lee Boyce, with the subject line, "Okay, I take it all back. My kettle took 4 minutes 10 seconds to boil."
Wow.
Can't quite believe it.
Shock.
But I was pulled up by one of our listeners. This is listener corner, not us talking about our kettle corner. Who for a statement that I made where I think I said something like cashback and things like that, I always thought not filling a kettle, with life was too short to not fill a kettle and worry about that. And he said, "Simon, look at the logic of life's too short to put less water in the kettle. It makes it boil quicker. You get more time to enjoy short life. Literally no downside to it." So
that's
100%. I regularly do say stupid things. I'm not always right. I'm often completely wrong. And yes, you're right. I make sweeping statements that are completely incorrect. I'm also the man who bought a Christmas tree that was too big for his house earlier this week, brought it home, took it into the garage, thought I'll take it into the garage first. I was like, it's like too tall, won't fit under the ceiling. I was like, ceiling must be lower in the garage. My wife came home. I carried the Christmas tree into the house. She was like, that is far too big. I was like, no, it's fine. I said, it's too big for the garage, but the ceiling's higher in here. She's like, no, it isn't. That's not going to fit. Christmas tree didn't fit. Had to take a bit off the top and a bit off the bottom. Oh. I am an idiot. Don't listen to everything I say. And when I say life's too short to not only put one cup of water in the kettle, I'm completely wrong. It obviously does make the kettle boil slightly quicker. And then just the final bit of listener corner. Lee said that he wanted to hear from you. One of our listeners went one better than that this week when I got on the train, sat down, and the man opposite me looked at me strangely, held up his phone and went, excuse me, is this you?
Simon, being recognised on the train, you're a celebrity.
He was listening to the podcast on the train. And because obviously it has the picture of us on the front of it, He'd literally just put it on and had it in his hand. And then I walked on, sat down the train next to him, opposite him. So it was very nice to chat to him. It was really great to hear from a listener. And we chatted for a while. We actually chatted about investing some stuff like that. And then I had to give my apologies because I genuinely actually did have to do some work on the train that morning. But yeah, that was very pleasant. So that's it for this week.
There you go.
We'll be ramping up Listener Corner next year, though. Yeah. So listen to the podcast in the coming weeks and you'll find out what our plans are.
Yeah, exactly. When we've worked out what they are. Anyway, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon, approach Simon on the train when he's trying to work.
I wasn't trying to work at the time. I was just sitting down. I did then have to do some work. Yeah. But anyway, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, stick podcast, and then whatever else the email is about in the subject line, because then we can easily find it in the email inbox. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And we'd like to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas. I did actually forget to do that, so we've had to start again. But Happy Christmas, everybody.
We would have kept in the bit where I had to remind her, but unfortunately she's got a foul mouth and she swore.
Dude, it's true. I'm so sorry. Merry Christmas, Tanya. Merry Christmas, Simon. Merry Christmas to you all listening, and Merry Christmas from us. If you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.